The divergent interests of mining, logging, labor, environmentalists, local business, and First Nations have often resulted in conflict and stalemate in British Columbia forests. A set of land use agreements for the North and Central Coast and the islands of Haida Gwaii stand to break this pattern. After years of community meetings, consultations, and scientific work, a solution to future development for the Great Bear Rainforest received broad support among stakeholders. Environmental groups working on the issue say these agreements represent a new, more holistic approach to conservation, and through them, unprecedented breakthroughs have emerged for this threatened region. The BC government is currently confronted with a choice to support these agreements based on the outcomes of government-to-government negotiations with First Nations. Amanda Carr is a forest campaigner with Greenpeace, and she joins us by phone this morning. Hello, Amanda.
Good morning, Lisa.
The area known as the Great Bear Rainforest covers 21 million acres. Can you give us a bit of a picture of the landscape and the ecosystem we're talking about?
I can. So the Great Bear Rainforest is the last large intact coastal temperate rainforest on the planet. And here in BC, it stretches from, if you were to draw a line across from the northern tip of Vancouver Island to the mainland, it stretches up that mainland coast all the way to Alaska. And the rainforest is remarkable because of its towering cedar trees and grizzly bears, rivers teeming with salmon, and as well the rare white spirit bear, which is a black bear that has a gene that makes its fur white, also lives in that rainforest.
And in terms of size, can you give us an idea of how big it really is?
So 21 million acres is the size of it, as you mentioned. This is an area sort of 15 times the size of Prince Edward Island, is the way that I think of it.
So the land use agreements for this area were the result of a process involving very diverse stakeholders, people ranging from mining and local business and First Nations, logging unions, and environmental groups. How do you explain the success of this process in achieving a compromise that was acceptable to such divergent interests?
Well, it began for Greenpeace sat down at the table in 2001. And what gave us the space to do that is really interesting, and it's starting to be looked at in models around the world. And basically, we were in an intense conflict. As you know, there were protests in the woods. We'd gone to the international marketplace asking customers not to buy wood from BC because of the way that the lands were being managed in the Great Bear Rainforest. And basically, we came to an initial agreement with stakeholders that said, okay, while we talk, we'll leave these areas off-limit to logging. And there were 89 valleys that were left off-limits to logging while we talked and while we decided the future of those valleys. So that was an important piece for us. In addition, time, right? We basically spent 4 years at that table talking about solutions and getting to know what the concerns and issues were for all of the people that came and sat down and talked.
So what's the range and the quality of the land that will receive full ecological protection?
The majority of areas being put into protection are representative of the ecosystems within the Great Bear Rainforest. So if you were to look at the overall percentage of low-lying valley forests in the Great Bear Rainforest in its entirety, a similar percentage is found within the protected areas. That being said, the protected areas, the areas that will be formally protected, only represent about a third of the region. So there are two-thirds still open to a new type of logging that are also part of the agreements.
And environmentalists are saying that in addition to this conservation, the ecosystem-based management model would be a major gain in these agreements. How does that approach work?
So that approach is all about balance. From an ecological perspective, it's about balancing risk across scales. So, for example, the two-thirds that remains open to logging, in that area, you could have light-touch logging everywhere, or you could choose to only log in some places and log a little bit more intensively because you know that overall you're maintaining low risk. It's also about balance for human well-being in local communities. So because there's that flexibility within the ecological management, commitment. It allows you to manage and ensure that local communities and their human well-being is also being taken care of.
In terms of economic development, how are the needs of the local economy dealt with in the agreement?
Yeah, this was a big part. I mean, when we sat down and started talking to stakeholders, including local communities, they said, yes, we want to do the right thing. We understand this region is globally significant. But they actually challenged the conservation sector specifically, you know, basically to put our money where our mouth is. And so what was developed was a conservation financing mechanism. And we actually had an economist come in and look at the coast and look what was needed to really diversify the economy on the coast. And $120 million was sort of the influx that was recommended. And so the conservation sector went out and committed to raise $60 million, expecting a $30 million contribution from the province and then matching a $30 million contribution from the federal government as well. And we have done that. We have $60 million that we're ready to bring to the table. And that fund will be available to local First Nations communities based on their own land use plans. And so there's a formula that's calculated based on the quality of habitat they're putting into protection, the area, and then their traditional territory. And then that money is distributed in the community through two different ways. A portion of it is put into a trust, and off that interest, First Nations and local communities can then manage their protected areas, restore some of the areas that have been logged if they're interested in protecting them. And then the other half is for sustainable businesses, things like shellfish, aquaculture, tourism.
Are there other reasons why First Nations have a stake in seeing these agreements go forward into legislation?
Absolutely. This is the first time in land use planning in British Columbia, which is a process that was established initially by the NDP and carried forward by the Liberal government. This is the first time that following the stakeholder negotiations, we've gone into a government-to-government negotiation. So beyond mere consultation, First Nations are at the table equally with the provincial government, matching the recommendations from the stakeholders to First Nations' own land use planning. And then those outcomes are expected to go to Cabinet, although we've been dealing with a lot of delays in seeing those pass through Cabinet.
And from the environmentalist perspective, why is it important that the provincial government move in a timely manner to implement these agreements in legislation?
Well, as you can imagine, after so many years of sitting down and talking and then we reached agreements in early 2004, it's very hard to maintain that stakeholder energy around the solution. Circumstances change, new players come to the table, and so it's important to act when you have this kind of solution in place. In addition, the $60 million that I discussed, some of those philanthropic donors have put that on the table for over 2 years as well, and they're dealing with tax implications of not having that money put into escrow. In addition, some of the investors that are interested in this region, you know, they can only wait so long to see a return on their investment dollars.
So where does the provincial government stand in relation to getting these agreements legislated?
Well, just prior to the election, Gordon Campbell wrote a letter to First Nations on the coast, and this commitment was echoed to Greenpeace as well, to finalize agreements with First Nations by September 30th. Now here we are just about before Christmas, with I'm sure everybody heading off onto holiday, and so the question really is, what is their commitment and when will these be passed?
Are you asking people to take action on this issue to put some pressure on?
We are. We have a fax action alert set up on our website, which is savethegreatbear.org, and people can go there and fax the Premier and let him know that acting on these agreements on this unprecedented solution, there's really is nowhere else in the world where this kind of collaboration has come together. So acting on these agreements is very important, and folks can do that by sending a fax from the website.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us this morning, Amanda.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Greenpeace Forests campaigner Amanda Carr, and as she said, there's more information on the Save the Great Bear website, and you can fax the Premier directly from there. That web address is savethegreatbear.org. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.